From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1999 when an elementary school principal in Rochester discovered that more than 40% of his incoming students had elevated blood lead levels. Those levels, he learned, were 20 times the national rate. The issue was rooted in housing. Unlike in most of Europe, where lead was banned from paint in the 1920s, the U.S. did not restrict the use of lead in residential paint until 1978. While rates of lead poisoning dropped significantly after the law was passed, children who lived in older homes were still exposed, and many of those homes were in low-income neighborhoods where families were directly affected by systemic racism. The disparity spurred action. Researchers, lawyers, healthcare providers, educators, and city leaders teamed up to address the issue. They formed a coalition, and their work led to city officials passing a lead law in 2005. 7 years later, the number of children with elevated lead levels living in that area decreased by more than 90%. As University of Rochester Medical Center Associate Professor Katrina Korfmacher writes, the case demonstrates how reframing the problem from just a health issue to a housing issue helped diverse groups create a workable solution. She says bridging those silos is key to addressing environmental health and justice issues, especially in urban communities. That's the theme of her new book, and it is appropriately titled Bridging Silos. In it, she explores three case studies from three different communities, including Rochester, to illustrate how collaboration is essential in creating better outcomes for underrepresented and disadvantaged populations. So this hour, she joins us talking about her research, the book, and how Rochester's efforts from the lead paint ban to its climate action plan can serve as models for other communities. So let's welcome our guest now, the author of Bridging Silos, Katrina Korfmacher, back on Connections. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Also with us is Elizabeth McDade, Program Coordinator for RENEW. That's the Rochester Energy Efficiency and Weatherization. What's the full RENEW here, Elizabeth? Because the last time we talked, I feel like we talked lead. We've talked lead so many times over the year.
Actually, the point of Katrina's book that it's all interconnected, right? When we're talking about the lessons that you learn and how do you take those lessons and put them into other parts of the community.
So, what does RENEW stand for?
It's the Rochester Energy Efficiency and Weatherization Climate Fund, and it's housed at the Community Foundation. And we're going to talk a little bit about the work that we've been doing to work with community partners to help make the homes of low-income owner occupants healthier and safer and more energy efficient.
Thanks for being here. Also with us is Dina Fatticone, who is the Director of Community Health and Engagement at Common Ground Health, and welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Katrina, I think there is an advantage that you have as you try to get us all thinking about how we can build not just healthier communities, but communities with more just communities, frankly. And the advantage is, I think kids who are becoming adults now have an almost instinctive view that obviously environmental health and public health are linked just because of climate change. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's true. And in fact, I think most people who live in urban communities know that. They experience that every day. The challenge is that the way we've set up our systems to manage those issues doesn't take that into account.
So we're going to talk in depth, I think, about what Rochester has done and frankly, what the impacts are. But let's talk a little bit about kind of trying to prove a negative here. When you look ahead in this city, but also in this country, if we don't do a better job at connecting environmental health to public health, what then? What are the negative outcomes that you fear could happen if we don't do a better job here?
Well, I think in the area of lead poisoning prevention, we can see that really clearly because there are lots of cities like Rochester that have big lead problems. Not all of them have been as successful as we have in reducing lead. So there was a study our health department did a couple years ago that showed that lead poisoning rates have come down 2.5 times faster in Rochester than anywhere else in upstate New York. So we can see what happens when you do connect those issues and when you don't.
Okay. And let me ask our other guests how you see it, too. Elizabeth, what are your concerns if we don't do better in these areas?
Well, there's so much data that actually underscores the connection between all of this. You know, in some ways, it's common sense, right? Like if you're going to be living in a home that doesn't have an asthma trigger, that is a healthier and safer place to live, you're going to be reducing your ED visits. You're going to be reducing medical costs. You're going to have increased disposable income to help you live a better life. And so we start seeing these types of relationships. I mean, it really is an expanding issue when you really start thinking about those impacts. And then going on to climate change, you know, making sure that we are really thinking about the environment that we're living in and the impact that it has not only on our own health, but on our world.
How do you see it, Dina?
I think really For me, it's about our resources. You know, we live in a day where we have limited resources, and the pie certainly isn't getting any bigger, if not shrinking. So it's really an opportunity for us to think about how these different sectors and systems can work together to share those resources, to braid funding, to really look at problems together and create a common agenda.
Dr. Korfmacher, who'd you write the book for? Who do you want the book? Whose hands do you want this book in right now?
Well, everybody is listening, of course, but I really want to make sure that it gets read by people who are in community groups and local governments who are struggling with these issues on the ground, because it's really difficult for local communities to learn from each other. And the kind of work we're talking about sounds really intuitive and easy. Let's collaborate. But if that were, that easy, everybody would be doing it. There are lots of barriers and things that get in the way of collaborating successfully. And by digging deep into these three case studies, I hope to show some of the challenges that you need to overcome in order to do that effectively.
You note in your book something interesting. If you go back a couple hundred years, there was a moment in our public health that should have reminded us that environmental health and public health would have to be linked, and that was sanitation efforts. You go back a couple hundred years, and those things were obviously linked. Why didn't we learn from that 200 years ago?
Well, that's actually where the whole field of public health started, right? Public health was environmental health. But as we learned more about where germs and disease actually come from, and we improved sanitation and improved medical care, vaccinations, and reducing infectious disease, those two areas separated, and we got technical experts to take care of our water quality and remove our trash and think about air quality, and different people, like the healthcare system, to think about human health. And those two fields grew farther and farther apart over time. But when we look at issues of environmental justice, we can see that a lot of communities' health has fallen through the cracks between those two systems.
The new book is called Bridging Silos, Collaborating for Environmental Health and Justice in Urban Communities. And the goals, as sort of laid out here in the book, are always about, first and foremost, ending an environmental injustice of some kind. So yes, lead in Rochester, but it's different in different communities. And the ways that that happens, according to the book, are integrating institutions. So yes, we just talked about, we saw it with sanitation, but integrating institutions and systems change. And if that sounds sort of wonky or jargony, you know, Katrina really does lay out in the book why it's we have to sort of get past the wonkiness and realize that it is hard, that things get entrenched, that when people want things to change, when they find injustice, it's hard to make that move. You pick three examples in your book. We know Rochester, and we're going to talk about that at more length. But why don't you tell me about the other two and tell our listeners about what you found there and why you think that they are good illustrations of this.
Sure. Well, first of all, there's work like this happening all over the country in lots of different areas. And I know that because when I talk about the Rochester lead case at national conferences or to colleagues at institutions in other cities, they tell us stories about what they've been doing. But those stories all take place in different places and different sectors, so there's not a chance for them to learn from each other. So I really wanted to find three different stories that we could learn lessons from that were all in places that had some level of resource constraints. Because these issues have been studied pretty extensively in places like New York City and San Francisco, where there are a lot of groups and a lot of resources trying to address them. But, you know, as I like to say about Rochester, if we're the third poorest city in the country and we can solve with some of the oldest housing stock and we can solve the lead problem, what's your excuse? So I was trying to find other places with different issues that that we might be able to learn replicable lessons. So Los Angeles is a big place, but it also was dealing with the massive economic forces of goods movement. Bringing over 40% of the goods that we use import into this country comes through the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. It gets brought here on ships that are polluting. It gets put onto trains, onto trucks to bring them to rail yards or warehouses to get shipped all over the country. And the communities that live near all of those facilities are suffering disproportionately, largely from air pollution, but also noise and lights, light and lots of other kinds of issues. And there was a group there that brought together four different communities with two academic institutions to see if they could change the whole system of how decisions about all of those things are being made to actually consider health, and particularly the disproportionate effects of health on the health of people living really close to these facilities.
Well, let me just jump in and say, when you think Los Angeles and Long Beach as the problem you outline, I think your readers are initially going to think you're going to have communities moving farther away, just geographically. That there's not going to be sort of a, and Elizabeth's already shaking her head at this, but it does seem like an income-based issue, that people with lower income are going to end up with this sort of the short end of the equation there. And you have to move them farther away, but that's not necessarily what happened. There was a lot of communication, sort of effective community engagement and communication that you outlined. What did you see happen there?
Well, if you look at discussions of expanding ports and growing rail yards and making those massive highways even bigger from as recently as 15, 20 years ago, there's no mention of health. But now if you look at those decisions, public health and particularly the health of the communities right nearby is first and foremost. So a lot of big decisions have been slowed down and rethought about, yes, we need to move these goods, but can we have zero emissions vehicles? Can we move them through communities in ways that aren't going to be causing such massive health effects? And can we do other things in those communities, quite frankly, like promoting parks and making the streets more bikeable and promoting green businesses that help mitigate some of the other environmental injustices that those people are already exposed to?
And there can be things as simple as rerouting traffic, correct? To actually not have an impact, for example, on a school. I mean, you know, there's really smart ways to think about and simple ways to think about this to start to move the needle.
You agree there, Dina?
I do. And I think, to Katrina's point, that if we simply get people to think about and consider health when they're making decisions, it could be as simple as just asking them what the health implications are going to be of a decision, to going as far as doing a full-out health impact assessment of a decision, which Dr. Korfmacher has, you know, brought to our community. So I do think just getting people to even think about health has been groundbreaking and mitigates some of the other impacts that these things have on communities.
Yeah, the Los Angeles Long Beach story made me think, interestingly enough, of interloops and the kinds of transportation that were cut through parts of our communities, our urban centers, especially when you go back to the 50s and 60s. And now there's a rethinking of that, this idea that, well, there were impacts in different ways. Pollution and health impacts, as you say, light and noise, property value and wealth accumulation, it all tied together. But Elizabeth, I see you nodding with that. Doesn't it feel like, at least to me, in the last decade, we're talking about this much more than I ever heard before, whether it's here with the Inner Loop or what we learned in Los Angeles and Long Beach and elsewhere?
Well, I think certainly in Rochester we're talking a lot about it. And I think a lot of that has to do with the Coalition to Prevent Lead Poisoning's work, and I think it has to do with what Common Ground Health has been doing, you know, with the African American Health Coalitions and Latino Health Coalitions. I mean, there are many different community or different organizations and groups in this community who have learned from, you know, the somewhat, it, you know, I think it's important to understand it was messy, you know, that sometimes this work is not easy. And if it weren't so important, it wouldn't be so hard. And that it's important to understand that sometimes it's going to take a little bit of mess to get there, but that we've learned so many great lessons out of it. And we've seen such immediate impact and such demonstrable impact. I mean, there's no way to argue that, you know, what this community did to reduce the number of children being reported with lead paint poisoning isn't something that other communities can take and translate into their own communities.
So before we move to Duluth, just to kind of close the loop on Los Angeles and Long Beach, often the people impacted almost always in a negative way by environmental injustice are people with almost no political power. What did you see there that you think can be an important lesson in any community where the people who are hurt the most have the least power?
That is often true, but one of the surprising things about each of these cases is that the communities that often have are disadvantaged and don't have power, the very unfairness of how they are disproportionately affected turned out to be a source of power. So pointing out the differences between the health the air quality that's experienced by children living really close to the I-710 versus people who are living farther away, just that unfairness really caught people's attention and said, we need to do something about this.
Okay. Now, your second example is where? Take us to Duluth now.
Duluth, Minnesota. I love Duluth. I have to say I hadn't heard of or been to Duluth till I started writing this book and researching it and thinking I really would like to look at a place that's different from LA or Rochester that's done promising work having to do with the built environment. And when I started asking people about where I might find such a case, I was pointed to Minnesota because Minnesota has done a great job integrating health into all its policies. In fact, health collaboratives were built into their health reform legislation like over 10 years ago. And talking to people in Minnesota, they said, you should look at Duluth. So Duluth is this city of 86,000 people. It's right on the westernmost shore of Lake Superior. It's a really, really cold place. And in 1986, it had the highest unemployment rates in the whole country. In 2014, it was rated the best town to live in the U.S. by Outside Magazine. So how did it go from there to there? And coming from Rochester, I was pretty curious about that story. So it has redeveloped despite the fact that it has the largest Superfund site in the entire state. And there's a lot of challenges there. But it has been improving. It's known as a trail center. Lots of people like to go there for mountain biking and skiing and recreational activities, but it wasn't, as the people there say, not all boats were being lifted at the same time. And so people there started thinking, how can we redevelop our built environment in a way that is equitable to everyone? And they were so successful that when their new mayor came in 2016, in her first State of the City address, she announced that she was going to integrate health equity as one of the key goals of their comprehensive plan.
This is a city that your book tells us, based on the 2010 census, it's just under half the size of Rochester.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And again, you may hear a term like, well, the mayor wants to institute health outcomes as part of the comprehensive plan. What does it really look like in practice, and do you find the evidence that it's working?
So as I said, this place is full of brownfields, mm-hmm. and Superfund sites. So they've done a lot of work to plan for how to redevelop those. And that means that they've talked very carefully with communities surrounding those sites and asked, what do you need? One of the things they found is that there were many communities that had to drive 20 minutes to get to a grocery store. So they came up with the idea of a grocery bus and just rerouting one of their existing buses, refitting it so it could take grocery bags and taking it straight from this neighborhood to the grocery store once a week. They had a municipal budget for redeveloping their trails, because I mentioned their bike trails are famous and they're very proud of them and they want to extend them, prioritizing redevelopment of those trails in low-income neighborhoods where people needed to use them for transportation, building community gardens and a greenhouse in one of the lowest income areas. So these are all specific ideas that have come out of looking at all these kinds of decisions from a health equity perspective.
Yeah, this is a place that, again, the book tells us lower life expectancy in low-income neighborhoods historically there. So what's a good long-term measurement? Obviously, number one has got to be just people aren't dying young. We're probably going to need a generation or more to see the long-term, aren't we?
Yes, possibly more, because we've had more than one generation causing sort of disparities in the first place. And I would say that, not to get too wonky again, but this is one of the reasons that we have silos, that it's easier to measure. If your job is to make sure that the air quality is meeting a certain standard, that's your job. And it's not to figure out if there are other things going on affecting people's health. And measuring the effects of these kinds of changes on people is much more difficult than something that looking at something more narrowly. And for that reason, we often have to look upstream. Have we changed the environment in ways that are likely to improve health? Have we changed policies in ways that are likely to shape that environment? Have we changed the way we make decisions to make them more responsive to what communities need?
Let me also just bring in Dina for this, because I think about our own community and what it means to truly create a multimodal community, because as Katrina points out with the bike trails, we can make the mistake sometimes of thinking about bicycle lanes, bike trails as something that, you know, sort of the granola gentrifiers like, you know, because, you know, the upscale white, you know, becoming more white neighborhoods and people like to bike. But for so many people, it is necessary to get to work, to get around. That's how you get around. And in Rochester, Our colleague Brett Dahlberg's done great reporting this year on bike lanes and just how seriously or not the city of Rochester takes it. And, you know, points out that members of government have had cars parked in bike lanes right outside City Hall at a time when the city is trying to tell people, you know, we take this seriously. How important is it that it's not just, hey, for fun, for, you know, for pedestrian and multimodal, but it's a vital quality of life for everybody issue?
Well, you know, you really hit the point. It's critical for people. And we always have to remember that even if we have the best transit system in the country, every bus trip starts with either a walking trip or a bike trip. So, you know, it really is impacting a lot of people. But there's always a chance to educate and bring awareness. So, you know, you mentioned Brett Dahlberg really shining a light on the bike lane issue, and the city took action. You know, they took it seriously, and people now know they didn't before. You know, we've had lots of bike lanes popping up in Rochester, and not everybody knows what that means or what the rules of the road are. So we've worked at Common Ground Health to start to change some of those norms, and we have a campaign called Drive to Be Better, where we're educating drivers on what does it mean if you come across a bike lane or a sharrow, which is less common, but, you know, a bike lane or a green box at a stoplight. What should you be doing? Because really, we started with drivers because they have the most power. But it really comes down to the city prioritizing these things in their decision making. So we talked about the comp plan, the comprehensive plan from Duluth. Rochester, you know, really, we can't talk highly enough about the steps Rochester took in developing Rochester 2034, the draft comprehensive plan that will be voted on in October. And we did a keyword search at Common Ground Health to look at, you know, health, playability, walkability, bikeability. How many are those things showing up in our comp plan? And I can tell you that health shows up 210 times in Rochester's comprehensive plan compared with our former plan, the Renaissance plan, where we had two mentions of health in that plan. Playability and walkability shows up 112 times. So these are things that the city is taking seriously, and the comprehensive plan will really guide decision making going forward.
I also want to just flag that I like the idea of a grocery bus that Duluth has. I think it just makes sense. And so a very interesting case study there. So there you've got Los Angeles and Long Beach. You've got Duluth, Healthy Duluth, and the Coalition to Prevent Lead Poisoning and the work that's happened in Rochester. Elizabeth, how much do you think this community's story with lead has impacted others? What have you heard?
I would say that we get requests. In fact, I just got an email this morning from somebody in Syracuse asking for information because mm-hmm. Syracuse is trying to do this. I was talking to friends in Buffalo. We've been working collectively across the state with organizations. We've been working with friends in Utica. I mean, there's a ton of work. New York City, I mean, the amount of people focused in New York State really looking at this issue, taking what Rochester has learned and trying to implement that in other places. We're very lucky in Rochester in that we already had the certificate of occupancy in place, so that actually made it easier to become more efficient about how that worked. But by utilizing that data, by actually tying that into health and housing, and now we just actually spent last October, we spent a day and a half with friends from Cleveland, and as a result of that work, they voted in a lead ordinance recently. I was there. I'm going to Newark, as I said, tomorrow. I mean, we are all over the place with this work.
Cleveland's my hometown. They largely do credit Rochester's example, don't they, Katrina?
They do, which is really gracious of them.
Yes.
Because we do look at that as a success story where they've done this right. I hate to pick on poor Benton Harbor, Michigan, because they tried to do the right thing. But like many cities, I think over 30 we've counted so far, they came to Rochester and said, we see the lead law you passed. It's fantastic. We want it too. They adopted that law within a couple of months, almost exactly like ours. And they haven't done any inspections and haven't seen a significant decrease in their lead poisoning rates. It's because the real lesson learned here is that people from health and housing and community and academia and government came together and figured out what was going to work for Rochester and built up an understanding of that and a commitment to making that happen. Just pulling a lever and copying the law is not what this is about. It's about the process of figuring out what the gaps are in your particular community and the solutions and systems changes that need to happen there. Cleveland seems to have done that.
And I will also say that at our last annual meeting for the Coalition to Prevent Lead Poisoning, it was when Cleveland was here. Commissioner Gary Kirkmeyer shared that he'd been coming to meetings for 12 years, you know. And part of this is this understanding that it's not about making a decision. I mean, it's about making a decision, but it's also committing to that decision and evaluating it as you go along and understanding that there are going to be things that you learn. Our lead law got amended after it got passed based upon data, based upon research. You're making sure that it was more efficient, making sure that it was actually doing what it was supposed to do. And we evaluate it every single year. The city actually publishes results on the city. We do the same thing with the health data that comes out of the health department. I mean, we are constantly looking at what is this year's data telling us? How do we get smarter about it? How do we become more efficient?
All right. In a moment, I want Katrina to tell you about you got a book event at Writers and Books tonight. There's a lot to make sure that you're up to date on with her new book. But a question from a listener, as we talked about L.A. and Long Beach as an example of where things can go in a better direction when you break down those silos, when you bridge the silos. A listener wants to know, what about the Trump administration's efforts to curb California's control on emissions bans? Do you see that as relevant to the discussion here?
Absolutely, because part of California's local solution to this big problem they have with air quality is that they need to be able to control the emissions coming out of the tailpipe of vehicles there more than anywhere else. So California is the only state that's allowed to make different decisions about emissions from cars for very good reason. They had controls in place before the Clean Air Act was passed, and they've carried that forward. The power of that to reflect local needs that's carried on for decades, I think, is very clearly shown in that example.
Yeah, your book talks about laboratories of democracy and the value that they can bring. And this appears to be a case where when the administration doesn't like the rules, perhaps they say it's an impact on the economy. Critics say it's an impact on who their best friends are in business. But those laboratories of democracy can kind of get squashed out by federal government at times here. Most of the time, though, do you think there's enough flexibility on the state and local levels to bridge these silos where people are interested, Katrina?
You know, it really depends on the issue, and I don't think this lets federal agencies or the national government off the hook. So I do think that when we have innovation in local places where they have the capacity to do that, you know, Rochester and Duluth and Los Angeles had enough capacity to experiment and to develop something nobody else has, and other places have learned from it, and state and federal agencies have learned from that as well. So yes, you need the capacity to innovate at the local level and also channels to learn lessons and share them with places that don't have that kind of capacity.
If you are a member of Writers and Books, the event tonight is free. And if you are not, it's just $5 for members of the general public. Starts at 7 p.m. What do you want people to take away from the event tonight at Writers and Books, Katrina?
Well, I really like to look at this book as starting with a real win for Rochester, you know, something that we did that now is looked at as a national example, and also inspiring some of the really important work that's going on in our community and other areas, having to do with our built environment, having to do with climate action, and showing that, you know, we do have the tools to make a big difference at the local level on lots of different issues and no matter where you live.
Let's take our only break of the hour and get right back to it with the author of the book, Bridging Silos, Collaborating for Environmental Health and Justice in Urban Communities. It's Dr. Katrina Korfmacher, who's a professor in the Department of Environmental Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Elizabeth McDade is with us, a program coordinator for Renew, the Rochester Energy Efficiency and Weatherization Climate Fund at the Rochester Area Community Initiatives through the
Community Foundation Initiatives, yeah.
Dina Fatticone is the Director of Community Health and Engagement at Common Ground Health, and we're right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about tariffs. Last week on this program, the UAW talked about their strike against GM, and they also mentioned, the workers did, that they think tariffs are necessary, that they are helpful for American workers and for the long-term American economy. Now, many economists have disagreed, and next hour, a debate about tariffs on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Some listeners have said, why aren't you talking impeachment? Trust me, all things considered, we'll have you covered, and I'm sure NPR News as well, no matter what happens there going forward. We're talking about the connection between environmental health and public health. We're talking about injustices and how to redress those and what has been working, especially in Rochester. Now, Elizabeth McDade is someone we've talked to about lead many times over the years, but there's been sort of an expansion in the mission, and I want to start there. Tell me about the work you're doing now.
So 5 years ago, the New York State Attorney General at the time made available to the city of Rochester $1 million as part of settlement funds. And he did that with other cities across New York State. And the caveat was that the funds had to be braided to help low-income owner occupants make their homes more energy efficient, weatherized, et cetera. We hadn't actually done that in this community, really having different partners like Pathstone NeighborWorks, ABC, City of Rochester, and Monroe County Department of Public Health sitting around and talking about how do you actually take those efforts and make an impact on homeowners. So in the past 4 years, we've actually helped over 200 low-income owner occupants make their homes more energy efficient, weatherized. We are now calculating energy cost reductions, and our clients are seeing about a 25% reduction. And we're also calculating carbon emission reductions based upon the lifetime of the intervention that goes into the home. So we're seeing over 3,000 tons of carbon are not being released into the environment. But what really happened was at the table, of all of the partners sitting at the table working together, they had worked somewhat a little bit, but they were also, you know, admitted competitors. And so what we've done at this point is actually tried to figure out how do we make the resources that we have, as Gina was saying earlier, really become more efficient to really help those people who need it. And we're also seeing better health, physical and mental health outcomes from our clients. 100% of the people who have a self-reported respiratory condition before we start their work state that afterwards they are feeling better and they're not going to the emergency department as much.
I don't mean to be glib about this observation, but I want to ask you about one other aspect of health. We talk about public health, we talk about environmental health, but sometimes when we talk about whether it's weatherization of homes, energy efficiency at home or even on a societal scale, there's this idea that our economic health will suffer. And I think we're seeing plenty of evidence that some of that sort of the apocalyptic idea that if we want to transform our homes or even our society when it comes to energy output, that we could destroy our economic prospects. You're laughing at that.
I am laughing because, you know, we have the example, and I alluded to this earlier, that, you know, when we were coming up with the lead ordinance, people said the housing market was going to crash. I mean, I have emails that are crazy talk. I mean, people just assumed that the world was going to end, that landlords were going to, you know, just leave town and sell all their properties, that it was going to be enormously expensive, all of this stuff. And none of that came true. You know, we're actually seeing improved housing stock. We're seeing improved health outcomes. And so I say the same is true for what we're talking about with this, is that, you know, when we're working with, we're actually right now working with Sustainable Homes Rochester, with Pathstone. We've put in heat pumps into the homes of 5 low-income owner occupants. And so, you know, we're really looking at how do we start getting, if we're talking about environmental injustice, if we're talking about all of that equity, how do we get clean heating and cooling technologies all over the place, not just to those people who can afford it?
Let me just plant a little flag here, because even though I host more than 500 hours of live conversations a year, there's probably a dozen moments a year that will stand out in my mind. Somebody will make an observation or a comment that I will remember almost in perpetuity, as old as I'm getting. And I think this is going to be one of those moments for me, because I don't know why I've never thought about it the way you just described. When we talk about, well, if you try to transform this, the economic costs, the floor is going to come out. I've never really thought about that in the context of the lead crisis in Rochester. But what you're telling me is people warned you. You can do this, but the housing market's going to fall apart.
It was a
nightmare.
It's going to
cost too much. It will never happen.
People need to go back and actually look at old Democrat and Chronicle articles, letters to the editor, all of that stuff. You know, that's also the myth of the Rochester model, that somehow, you know, 12 years in, where everybody's all hanging out and we're all figuring it out, it's all good. You know, our community partners from the health department and from the city will readily admit that they had to be dragged with their fingernails scratching down the wall to come to these community meetings, because really. But what came out of this, and really, I mean, it takes time to develop relationships, to develop trust, to not throw people under the bus, to make huge and awful and messy mistakes, and figure out still how do you keep going? Because, as I said earlier, if it weren't so important, it wouldn't be easy.
But why do you think people were warning of a housing market collapse and economic pain? If we addressed
lead. Katrina can probably better talk about that.
Do you think those were good faith warnings that people really thought this would happen?
I think they didn't really know what they were talking about.
Well, it's scary, right? People haven't done that before. You're outside of their comfort zones. You're asking them to span boundaries and get into areas they haven't done before. We were the first place to do this. So the only model that people knew for lead hazard reduction could cost $30,000 a house. But we figured out a way by listening to everyone, including property owners and renters and housing specialists, to reduce lead hazards in a way that was going to be a lot more cost effective. So it wasn't that they were lying or that they were just wrong. It's that we listened and came up with a solution to really take those concerns seriously.
So they took that initial baseline. And they just assumed that's how much it's going to cost, and we're going to sink the market.
Change is hard.
But the reason I bring that up in comparison now, because when we talk about energy across systems, we talk about climate change. That is one of the main points. From George Will to so many others, they've said even if we want to do this, we will crush the economy in doing it. In the same way they predicted the housing market would be crushed in Rochester.
I will just say that this is a really great example of how community, government, you know, educational institutions, everybody that you listed in your shopping list of stakeholders, you know, have ebbed and flowed, have come together, have tried to figure this out because they committed to doing it. I mean, we're talking about permanent, you know, with lead poisoning, we're talking about permanent brain damage for children, as well as the lifelong impacts. I mean, you know, people look at the maps of redlining and all of that stuff. Look at the maps of kidney damage and look at the maps of people who have high blood pressure. I mean, those are all correlatives that go beyond, you know, that type for individuals long term. So when we really start thinking about, and we're seeing reductions in all of this, right? I mean, Rochester has to understand that this is an enormous success story that does not get told often enough, that is not used as a way to actually sit there and go, we figured it out for this. And by the way, that seemed impossible. It seemed absolutely impossible. We figured that out. It wasn't perfect. We're still figuring it out. We're still working on it. It was two steps forward, one step back, all kinds of things. But if you decide you're actually going to do something, then do it and keep figuring it out. And the world is not going to end. It's going to get better.
You want to add to that, Dina?
Yeah, I think what hasn't entered the discourse is the cost of not doing something.
Thank you.
And at Common Ground Health, we've, you know, been looking at a lot of data around health equity and health inequities and what that costs us as a community. And we can see that annually we are spending hundreds of millions of dollars because of health inequities that could be avoided if we took the risk and came together to develop some of these solutions like the Lead Coalition has.
Hmm. Can you want to add to that, Katrina?
So this dates me a little bit, but I can't stop thinking about your previous caller about how all of these systems are connected. And, you know, we're in a place where it's not a lot of fun to be thinking about environment and health at the federal level. But no matter who sits in the White House, we still are going to see bigger impacts on people who are living in poverty in urban areas. And I remember being so stunned in 1993 when the Iron Curtain fell and the key role that was played by environmental groups of people who saw the effects on their lives of the Eastern Bloc industrial model. And it was that realization that helped them mobilize to affect the whole system. So I think the lesson learned there, it's never a bad idea to invest in grassroots community organizing around environment.
Amazing. We're just such great context here, and I think that's what the book has pulled together as we talk to Katrina Korfmacher about her book, Bridging Silos, Collaborating for Environmental Health and Justice in Urban Communities. And some of these books will have like a hero figure, though I do suspect at some point somebody will write the Elizabeth McDade story, which might be its own hero novel. You're nodding over there.
No, it's absolutely the Katrina Korfmacher story. I'm hurt. No, honestly. No, you know, I mean, it's always grass is greener, right? I mean, outside of Rochester, she's a rock star. I mean, the idea of her being this national expert and leader in this, international leader and expert in this, I mean, the impact that she's had, that the founders of the coalition, I'm not one of the founders, I came in after they founded it, have the impact that they've had on millions of children is an untold story that's incredible.
Well, and I'm sure Katrina will sort of humbly deflect that compliment.
Yes,
but the reason I brought up the idea of a hero is because sometimes you know, readers will pick up a book like this thinking, well, who's the person that led the story in Duluth and who's that person in Rochester? But it's not just one. The whole notion of silos is it's impossible to do this if you don't have many across groups. Is that fair?
Absolutely. And it is kind of fun looking back at these stories to realize that there was sort of an outsider, someone who wasn't part of managing health or environment, who said, this makes no sense. And here we often point to Ralph Spezio, realizing that lead was coming from houses and it was getting into the kids he was trying to teach, and that made it impossible to teach them. And this was just wrong. And it wasn't his job to fix the houses, and it wasn't his job to take care of their health, but he just focused on kids and their educational potential. And then other people whose job it was, responded to what he was asking for because they were frustrated by this too. And by bringing people together and asking the question a different way, it was like he was a magnet that brought in all these different forces. And yes, I've been fortunate to be the storyteller and be able to watch that. And Elizabeth has recognized how special that is and how it needs to be shared.
I think, you know, the other part of the secret sauce here and that I would give Elizabeth and Katrina props for is that this is a long game. You know, they have been in this for a long time. The Lead Coalition has had many homes in the community. At times has had funding, at other times has not had funding. But they've really been able to keep people at the table despite those constraints that have arisen. And it's really easy as a community to set your sights on something and expect quick results, and when you don't see them, to walk away or move to the next thing.
Or especially when administrations change in government, you get new faces. Absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah.
And we also have to give credit to City Council at the time. I mean, you know, they were besieged, and they made the right decision, and we are the better for it.
Let me go ahead and get some feedback from listeners. First, an email from Nathaniel, who says, because of lead issues in Rochester, there has been a blanket ban on growing food plants in the soil on city-owned land, regardless of what actual soil test results for the site may show. It's essential to protect residents from lead poisoning, but such a policy doesn't take into account how lead exposure actually happens in a potential garden environment, how plants interact with and sequester heavy metals, and simple ways to mitigate exposure risk. It has limited the growth and potential impact of urban agriculture in communities that could really use it. That comes from Nathaniel. He says he'd like to see Rochester adopt policies like Cleveland's, where the city works with gardeners to get soil tested and develop a use plan for land based on those tests. What do we know about that? How do we feel about that idea?
We always say use raised beds, but we are happy to learn stuff from our friends in Cleveland.
Okay.
Sure.
Katrina, you agree?
Use a raised bed.
use a raised bed.
I get it, but...
Yeah, I think, you know, in ecology, it's this principle, it's the precautionary principle, right? And while we do understand some of the mechanisms, I think as a community, we've come together to say no level of lead exposure is acceptable.
Okay. Thank you for that, Nathaniel. Let's get to your phone calls. Dan and Webster. Go ahead, Dan.
Hey there. Thanks for the conversation. This is awesome. I'm excited to read this book. So I have 2 points and a question. One about public health, like following from and being inextricably linked to environmental health is like a forgotten kind of common sense for like at least our political class, but it hasn't been forgotten by everyone. Just a quick mention, the Green Party didn't forget this obvious relationship, and Dr. Jill Stein, who has carried their presidential nomination the last couple times, it's her foundational principle, and it's why she's in politics, because she started as a medical doctor and realized that the environmental problems were, she was behind the eight ball and putting out fires based on environmental factors making people sick. But then that's off to the side. My main point is that there's also hurdles to doing this like kind of restorative health work that we wouldn't necessarily think of. For example, like Clinton's Telecommunications Act, which I think was 94, expressly forbids states and municipalities from considering public health concerns of telecom infrastructure. You can check out the document, do a control F, search for health, and you'll find it. If you want, I can email it to you, Evan. But for example, so if Verizon wanted to build out or develop some sort of infrastructure that was a health concern or a potential health concern, any encumbrance on their plan in the name of like investigating that health concern, even studying the issue to determine if it was a health concern, would be illegal under the Telecommunications Act, and Verizon would have legitimate grounds to sue whatever state or municipality raised that concern. So my question is, what might we try to do about laws that are already on the books that'll restrict our ability to, like, make this progress?
Dan, I'm going to ask you a quick question before I let the panel answer yours.
Sure.
Do you view this as a capitalism problem?
I would say it's inextricably linked.
The reason I ask that is because sometimes people who lead industries help write laws. And what you're describing are the kinds of impacts when that happens.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The telecom industry definitely had a hand in producing that legislation. And so, I mean, it makes sense that that legislation would look out for their interests before the public.
Yeah, please send me an email on the side with some background there. I'd love to read it, as always.
Sure.
Always appreciate that. Thank you, Dan. Let's let our guests answer the question then. What do we do about that, Katrina?
Well, I think the most effective way to organize around problems like that is to look where there's a problem and help people see, you know, what are the effects of that policy that he mentioned? What are the health impacts of not being able to consider public health in a proactive way? And that's why I like looking at these issues at the local level, is there are so many barriers put in place at the federal level that sometimes are easier to bridge locally, and then we can learn lessons that trickle up.
Okay. Do you find yourself, though, looking at sort of the landscape as Dan describes it, because we could talk energy, we could talk about who writes energy bills.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need systemic change in who's allowed in the room to write bills and how these things happen to prevent really wide-scale abuse in the future in that way?
So one of the things that worries me most in that realm is preemption. So obviously it makes sense for a lot of laws to be at the federal level so we have consistency, so we can trade freely and move around between the states. And there are other things that at a state level need to be consistent. And chemicals policy is a great example of that. But the challenge is that a lot of industries and people who don't want progressive controls to protect the environment and health have figured that out and are trying to preempt local initiatives, mostly at the state and federal level. And I think that's really dangerous.
Here's a comment from a listener, Kate McArdle, who has done a tremendous amount of work in our own community in many of these kinds of issues. She says, Katrina Korfmacher is definitely a hero, definitely my hero. The lead prevention story in Rochester wouldn't have happened and continue to be such a success without her, period. So that comes from Kate. Katrina did not want this to just to be a love hour for her, but, you know, your fans are coming out of the woodwork here.
Well, that gives me a chance to say I'm really, really fortunate to be in a university, but be able to work with community. You know, a lot of times we think academics just sit in their ivory towers, and most of them have to, because that's, you know, they have to get grant funding. They spend a lot of time teaching. But I'm really lucky that part of my job is to work with great people in the community, like those in the room and Kate. And there's so much leadership here. So one of Kate's most recent efforts has been co-chairing with Pamela Reed Sanchez, an environmental justice task force to inform the Finger Lakes Regional Economic Development Council. Now, if you think of a way to shape the future of this community by through the lens of environmental justice, which is environmental health, that's a really powerful starting place.
That's great stuff. Thank you, Kate, as always, for that comment. Awesome to hear about all the things happening in our own community. I'm going to squeeze in one more phone call. It's Walter in Penfield. Go ahead, Walter.
I wonder if the author is aware of the fact that the first concentrated drive against lead poisoning was initiated out of the Urban League in 1966 in cooperation with Dr. David Wilson of the Chemistry Department of the University of Rochester, and the Urban League had a youth group led by Dr. David Anderson, who is now at Nazareth, that collected samples, the peeling paint samples from residents, and it was the first concentrated effort to deal with the problem of lead poisoning in the community. And it was supposed to be a continued effort, but since the Urban League, I got off the board some years later and lost contact. But in 1996, at school number 17 in the city a survey of lead poisoning among those students, found that 42% of them had varying degrees of lead in their system.
Well, let me just jump in, Walter, because we're going to lose time. You're aware of the history there?
Absolutely. So Dr. Cooper and Dr. Anderson's pioneering efforts are really remarkable, not just in our area, but nationwide. And the Lead Coalition here is really fortunate to stand on the shoulders of those giants.
Absolutely.
Walter, thank you for calling, Dr. Cooper.
Yeah, my gosh.
I mean, there's a legend. There's a rock star.
It is always an honor to get a phone call from Dr. Cooper. And Dr. Cooper, I wish we had more time, but we're running up against the end of the program. Want to let you know tonight, Writers and Books, 7 p.m., Dr. Korfmacher will be there. Anything else you want the listeners to know?
Yeah, I'm really, really honored that MIT Press has made the book open access, which means you can download it for free from their website. By all means, if you want a copy, go ahead and buy one from their website. But I am really glad that it can be shared openly with the public.
The book is called Bridging Silos, Collaborating for Environmental Health and Justice in Urban Communities. And I'll just add that you're right, it's not just ivory towers. And overuse of ivory to construct towers is bad for the environment anyway. So it's good that you're not even doing that. These are people doing real work on the ground, from Dr. Korfmacher, Elizabeth McDade, Dina Fatacone. Thank you for making our communities healthier and more just. We really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
Short break. More Connections coming up.